From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing
off. This was not a great week for Donald Trump. At the last minute, he and Paul Ryan had to pull their big health care bill from the House floor because they couldn't get the votes. And James Comey told the House Intelligence Committee that the FBI is investigating possible coordination between Trump's associates and Russia. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jill Filipovich, lawyer, journalist, and author of the forthcoming book, The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. And our special guest is Susan Hennessy. She's a national security fellow at the Brookings Institution and the managing editor of Lawfare.com. So, in case you weren't following the drama on Capitol Hill on Friday, here's a rough summary of what happened.
You don't have the votes.
You don't have the votes. You're gonna need congressional approval, and you don't have the votes.
Of course, that's from Hamilton. Donald Trump demanded that Republicans put their health care bill on the floor for a vote on Friday, whether or not they had the votes. But he was bluffing, and when it became clear that Republicans did not have the votes and could not get the votes by threatening to hold the vote whether or not they had the votes, they decided not to have a vote at all. At 3:30 on Friday, Republicans announced the vote was off, and at 4, Ryan addressed the press to explain how they failed. And then Trump came out with a warning.
Gee, I hope it does well. I would love it to do well. I want great health care for the people of this nation. But it can't do well. It's imploding and soon will explode. And it's not going to be pretty.
Republicans voted 60 times to repeal part or all of Obamacare over the last 6 years. And then once they actually got control of Congress, they totally choked. Rich, how did we get here? And where do Republicans go from this?
Well, there are a couple things. One, the schedule was always insane because they thought they would just be passing a repeal bill they passed a year ago and got to President Obama's desk for a veto. But under pressure from President Trump, appropriately, I think, they decided to do repeal and replace jointly. So once you're doing the replace, it's a much trickier proposition. And they thought they would do this in 4 weeks. As a friend of mine says, Congress oftentimes takes more time to name a post office. And they thought they were going to do this hugely complex piece of legislation on that time frame based on sheer political muscle. It wasn't crazy. As recently as last week, I thought the odds were they'd at least get it through the House. But the negotiating wasn't good. President Trump didn't know what he was doing on some important questions. He helped bring it down by giving a concession to the House conservatives on the so-called essential health benefits that repelled more moderates than it won over conservatives. And he had no idea the policy consequence of making this move, which he did on his own without Ryan's approval or the approval of any of his staff. And just underlying all this, the bill wasn't good. They would have spent years trying to fix and live down this piece of legislation, even if it had passed in 4 weeks. So all of that helped undo it, and there's just no sugarcoating this. It's a debacle.
You know, Susan, I've been seeing the statements coming out from Democrats today, and there's been a certain amount of gloating, I would say. Chuck Schumer put out a statement, said, quote, "I have never in my life seen an administration as incompetent as the one occupying the White House today." And it's interesting what Rich describes. I think, you know, Trump looked at this and said, well, you got to do the replacement. But he also looked at it and said, you know, nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. Why shouldn't we be able to do this in 4 weeks? I guess I'm just, you know, thinking as we saw them stumble through the process, have you seen a signature legislative initiative that had a trajectory that looked anything like this before?
Humiliating for the deal. This is obviously sort of humiliating for the dealmaker in chief to have essentially not delivered the deal. And I think it's I don't know that I've ever seen such a haphazard or chaotic legislative process. You know, that said, I'm not sure that the Democrats are right to gloat right now. You know, obviously there are systemic problems with Obamacare. And so I think that they would be wise. You know, you already heard Trump sort of saying, well, maybe I'll make a deal with the Democrats. I think they'd be wise to sort of capitalize on that and start showing that, you know, they are the party in Congress that can actually get things done here.
Yeah, Jill, what do you make of that? You have Trump out today sort of almost saying, nice healthcare system you have here, would be a shame if anything happened to it. There have been some, you know, Obamacare, I think, has disappointed people in various ways. The premiums are higher than people would like them to be. The plans don't cover as much as they wanted. But then the other thing is that there's a lot of discretion that the executive branch has over the implementation. The Obama White House was doing a lot to hold the law together with duct tape. And on the flip side, you'd assume that Trump could do a lot to undermine it if he wished. So how do Democrats deal with him, sort of the simultaneous opportunity and threat?
I think Democrats have a great opportunity here. I mean, one is just to offer up their own version of an Obamacare kind of rehab of what they would do better. I think especially given how, frankly, cruel the Republican version of this bill was, that, you know, cutting essentially everything that insurance offers. So giving insurance companies the option whether or not they cover emergency services, whether or not they cover maternity care, whether or not they cover care for newborns. That really showed this, I think, fairly horrific vision that Republicans have for the country. And I think here Democrats can both offer a position that kind of makes them look like the real adults in the room, and that also offers a competing vision for what they would like to see for American society and for our healthcare system, which I think could put them in quite a strong position in the midterms.
The funny thing, Rich, is that, you know, you have Trump out there saying, you know, maybe I can work with Democrats now, this thing is going to explode. But it's clear from the way Trump handled this week and saying if they don't vote Friday, then I'm going to move on, is that Trump would like nothing better than to never have to think or talk about healthcare again. So I guess, you know, if the idea Republicans now hope that they can move on to tax reform, I'm just wondering if you look at this debacle and the bad blood it must have created in Congress, can they really come out of this and make a deal on tax reform?
Well, there's going to be a lot of lack of trust among everyone now on the Republican side. So when Paul Ryan shows up tomorrow and says, hey, I have this great idea for border adjustment tax as part of tax reform, yeah, there's some doubts about it in the Senate, but just let me bulldog it through the House and everything will be fine. The White House isn't going to believe him, and nor will Ryan think that Trump is the closer that everyone said, including Ryan himself, over the last 2 weeks. And tax reform is not any easier. It's just as complex. It involves just as many painful trade-offs. So the idea that you're going to just glide without a hiccup from this bill going down to an amazing success on tax reform, which Treasury Secretary Mnuchin says they'll pass by August, I think is a fantasy.
But so I think the same issues that of trust there that exist with Republicans in Congress exist only, you know, tenfold with Democrats in Congress. So if they was going to try to do a health care fix or something like that, you have the question of can we trust Trump? And then even if you get over that hurdle and decide you can, do you believe enough in his competence to get the legislation done? I mean, Susan, when I look at questions about is this bill going to pass, is this initiative going to happen, I feel like the first assumption in Washington should be there will be no change unless there absolutely has to be change. And I guess the question is, are there any areas where Trump and Congress really have to do things together this year?
Yeah, so clearly there are sort of must-pass, you know, legislative agenda items. I think Trump actually has a bigger problem here, which is that the House Republicans and the congressional Republicans in general just learned what the Chinese learned earlier, which is that Donald Trump is a paper tiger. He threatens a lot. He sort of talks a big game. But, you know, if he now is actually not going to go ahead and punish people who came out against him. And so the real question for Trump is, considering he's sort of gone in, all in on that kind of bullying tactic, what's he going to do when the House and Senate are no longer afraid of him or his base?
How much of this, we sort of look at the inability of Republicans to come together here, how much credit should Democrats take on the organizing side? Obviously, there have been all these calls to congressional offices and those sorts of things. It seems like a vindication that, you know, political reality still matters. When a bill has a 17% approval in the polls, that makes it harder to vote for it, even if it's on your party's agenda and you control the Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I think Democrats can take a lot of credit for this. Not only the calls to Congress, but, I mean, a very clear targeting of Republican Congress people who are in vulnerable districts. You look at Republicans who are in districts in areas that Hillary Clinton won. Those Republicans are not very keen on voting for a bill that cuts maternity care, that cuts mammograms for women, that really will displease a lot of their constituents. And I think it was a great organizing strategy on behalf of both Democrats and then this really grassroots lefty movement that sprung up in the aftermath of Trump, that, you know, it's taking to the streets, writing letters, writing op-eds, has really been pretty tireless in showing up and opposing every major thing that Trump has done.
Rich, do you think this breaks the dynamic at all where basically because Trump is so popular with the Republican base, Republicans have had up until this point seemed afraid to cross him. And here it might have been a special circumstance because Trump was so demonstrably uninvested in this bill, except from the idea that he thought he had to get something passed. Is this are the fissures created from this going to undermine Republicans' ability to hold together on the on other things?
Yeah, quite possibly. You know, I think a real break between the president and congressional Republicans is possible. I think if it happens, it would be further down the road. But this would be a step toward that rupture. And the basic difficult dynamic in Washington is you have a president who ran and won as a populist without a Congress and without even a wing in Congress. There are very few people who ran a Trumpist-style campaign. So it's this weird shotgun marriage, and it's made even more awkward by the fact that Trump, he had a message and he found a constituency, but he doesn't really have an agenda at all. And you would think if he was following up on his ideologically heterodox populist campaign, the first thing he would have done was infrastructure spending and try to make it really awkward for Democrats to oppose him on it and roll Republicans when he was at the high tide of his influence in January shortly after his inauguration. Well, if he wants to try to go back to and doing that now, it's much harder because he's already called Chuck Schumer a clown repeatedly, and he's lost some capital here, so it would be harder to roll Republicans.
Well, and then there's also one other burgeoning thing that is going to cause trouble with Trump interacting with Congress, which is these investigations in Congress related to Russia and the 2016 election. And you had this House Intelligence Committee hearing on Monday where FBI Director James Comey and NSA Director Mike Rogers testified about the inquiry into Russian interference in the election. Comey said he had no information to support Trump's claims that Barack Obama had ordered surveillance of him in those Saturday morning angry tweets from a few weeks ago. He also, I think more importantly, confirmed that the FBI is investigating not just Russia's actions, but possible coordination between Trump's associates and Russia during the campaign. Now, during this hearing, it sort of felt like the Republican Committee Chairman, Devin Nunes of California, was trying to run interference for Trump, at least at times. At one point, he was sort of incredulously saying, how could it possibly be true that Russia would prefer a Republican president over a Democratic president? And then you had this behavior from Nunes through the week, where on Wednesday he had this impromptu press conference saying that he'd seen concerning new information from a source about how government agencies had been surveilling the Trump transition. And then he ran off to the White House to brief the president about it, the person who is being investigated by their committee, before he shared with his own committee staff what he had seen. And then finally, on Friday, he canceled planned hearing for the following week with some Obama-era intelligence officials, which Democrats on the committee strongly objected to. Susan, what is going on here? Normally, we expect partisan behavior from congressional committees, but isn't the Intelligence Committee ordinarily supposed to be somewhat different?
Yeah, so usually they do rise above this level of sort of partisanship. I mean, one of the things that was marked about the hearings on Monday was it was like there were two hearings going on, right? There was a Republican hearing related to sort of who had leaked information about General Flynn and, sort of concerns really about the secrecy issues of the intelligence community. And the other was sort of about the substantive Russia issues. So there's obviously sort of a huge gap or fissure in that committee that I've certainly never seen before on the House or Senate side. In terms of sort of Nunes's particular conduct, I think it's still sort of inexplicable. I mean, clearly he's himself said, hey, you know, the president was taking a lot of heat for this, so I felt like I had a duty to say something. The problem is that the claims he sort of brought forward to the public that seemed like these show-stopping, you know, I have information that the intelligence community did wiretap Trump, actually turns out to be not only maybe he isn't sure that it happened, but he actually might be describing a form of incidental collection where other foreign targets just happened to be discussing Trump. So really, it's such a strange strategic move on his part. I think ultimately he harmed the White House's interest here because it's going to make it more likely there's select committee, some kind of bipartisan commission, because he's really undermined his own investigation.
We'll be back with more on this in a moment, but let us know what you think about the Trump-Russia investigation on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Jill Filipovich. She's a journalist and author of The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness, which comes out in May. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Susan Hennessy, National Security Fellow at the Brookings Institution and managing editor of Lawfare.com, is also with us. So, Rich, as this happened with Nunes this week, during and after the hearing, my interpretation of what was going on was that Nunes has generally been one of the more Trump-favorable intelligence people on the Hill. He was involved in the transition. The Senate Intelligence Committee has generally been viewed as the one that was likely to do a more serious investigation. And so it was sort of surprising that this quite damaging public hearing ended up happening in the House. A little weird that Nunes had agreed to have this public hearing in the first place. So my read of it is that he saw what happened in this hearing and how bad it was for Trump, and then he was sort of scrambling to figure out how to contain the damage, didn't want to have more of these hearings. Is that, do you think that's what happened?
Possibly, but I don't discount the possibility also that truly there is something disturbing that happened with these transcripts of incidental collection that happened with Trump officials whose conversations were picked up with other people who were legitimately being surveilled, and then their identities were unmasked, and then these transcripts were spread throughout the bureaucracy. I mean, I don't think it's outside of the imagination that that happened, and it's wrong. It's a cause of concern and for investigation. But clearly, this the House Intelligence Committee now is not a good vehicle for this investigation. We have to see whether the Senate Intelligence Committee can step up, and if not, go to a select committee.
I'm trying to figure out what is the end game here? I mean, obviously, Democrats, a lot of Republicans are upset about this. Democrats are very upset about this. But like, whatever we find here, it's not like we're going to get a new election. It kind of feels to me like, you know, what if we do find that Roger Stone or somebody was coordinating with the Russians about what to release? What's the end game, Jill?
I don't know that there is a clearly laid out one, but I'm not sure that that invalidates the investigation. I mean,
oh,
I think all of us,
not.
Of yeah. course, want to know what the truth is. And, you know, if this does end up being some sort of massive scandal, maybe you don't get a new election, but maybe you do get an impeachment. And obviously that, you know, depends on what comes out of all of this. But I mean, I think at this point, obviously, the Congressional Committee has totally lost credibility here. And it's not often that I agree with John McCain. But, you know, it's time for an independent committee. And the fact that this is even a partisan fight, that Republicans aren't more interested in figuring out if a hostile foreign power intervened in our elections. That to me is just such a sort of sad and pathetic commentary on our political situation today.
Susan, if a foreign operative comes to you and says, "We have obtained these embarrassing documents related to your opponent, would you advise us on when and how to release them?" Is that a crime?
Yeah, so it depends. There's the fundamental question of sort of just good judgment. What would an ordinary person, an ordinary patriot, one might say, do? Most people pick up the phone and call the FBI, right? Sort of being aware of there being, some sort of counterintelligence or foreign intelligence operation against the United States. That said, in terms of what kind of criminal conduct might be at stake here, you know, we don't know, right? If they solicited hacking, if they paid for things, if they were aware of criminal conduct, there's conspiracy. I mean, sort of, it's the full range. The problem is right now we're in the realm of more or less utterly, utter speculation. Nobody sort of knows what happened. The problem is there's so much smoke at this point that really the American people need an answer, right? They need to sort of restore the legitimacy of kind of the office of the president of this election. And so that's why it really is going to be incumbent upon Congress not just to get answers sort of for their own legislative purposes, should they impose sanctions and how they should otherwise respond to President Trump, but also for their constituents.
Because the thing that I keep hanging up on here in terms of why I've become a little bit resigned or cynical about this investigation, and obviously, as we've discussed on the show, like my husband's emails were a major part of this. So I have personal investment in this. And yet it just feels like to me that the case to voters about what happened is basically, you know, people were more or less tricked into voting for Trump instead of Hillary because of this theft and this nefarious action. I don't think you're ever going to convince people that they voted one way instead of the other way because of a Russian intelligence operation. And therefore, if you say to people that people will say, yes, that's bad, but what is there to be a remedy for here? Because it's, you know, nobody's going to say, well, my vote was changed by this Russian operation.
Right. And I think the evidence shows the Comey letter was much more consequential than the drip drip of these leaks. You can't know for sure. But Hillary took definitely a big jag down in the polls when the Comey letter came out. And whatever else you think of how Comey handled that, he is an American. You know, I don't think he even speaks Russian. And I've always been skeptical of the conspiracy theory about the Trump campaign, because I don't know why the Russians would have had to coordinate with them. And if you want sort of strategic advice on how something's going to play in American politics, the last place you would have gone, you know, in the summer of 2016 was to the Trump campaign. But, you know, maybe it did happen. We certainly should know, just as a matter of small Democratic, small D Democratic hygiene. And these characters around Trump, Flynn, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, are not trustworthy figures, especially, all of them, but Manafort especially, with the Russian connection in the AP story this week about, you know, pitching a Ukrainian oligarch, a Russian-connected Ukrainian oligarch, for $10 million worth of business to influence the image and the standing of Russia in the West.
Of Vladimir Putin, personally.
Yes, yeah. which is very concerning, to put it mildly. And as a friend of mine who follows this stuff closely asked this week, what kind of made me go, you know, Paul Manafort, he says, is a man who cares about getting paid. He volunteered, supposedly, for the Trump campaign. So who was paying him?
So we have that story, and then there was also this story this week about that during the campaign, Mike Flynn was in a meeting with various Turkish officials and former CIA director James Woolsey, in which they discussed ways that they could get this cleric, Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania, back to Turkey without actually extraditing him to Turkey, sort of like forcibly removing him from the country. And this is another thing that I look at. It's like, it's so shady. This guy ended up working in the White House, even if only briefly, and by the way, did not sign the pledge that he was supposed to sign against lobbying after he got out of the White House. But I look at this again, Susan, like, is there a remedy for this? Is that potentially a criminal action? I'm just trying to figure out whether Donald Trump and the people around him can be punished other than politically for what looks like extremely shady behavior.
Well, so look, the Flynn question is sort of complex. Of course, it depends on what he said to the FBI, what he said on his SF-86. But this does have much bigger sort of ramifications for Donald Trump as president, right? So there were all of these red flags about Michael Flynn. Donald Trump was clearly aware of some form of his contact with the Russian ambassador discussing sanctions. This issue of sort of whether or not he'd worked for the Turks. Now, you know, the White House is sort of acting as though they're being caught by surprise here. But this is something that was reported mere days after the election. And recall that Michael Flynn had written this sort of pro-Turkey op-ed the day of the election, I believe, sort of calling for Gulen's extradition. So the real question is, why did Donald Trump select that person to become the national security advisor? Why did he ignore all of these sort of red flags and derogatory information? That's the kind of stuff that really goes to a question of basic judgment. And I think it really begs the question, who else in government is holding a high-level security clearance right now that has similar sort of red flags that we should be aware of?
So one line we've been hearing this week has been that the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to sit on the Supreme Court should be delayed until we can get to the bottom of this Russia investigation, because we don't, you know, do we really want Donald Trump putting people in the American judiciary while he's under this light? Is this, I mean, this sort of feels like a pretextual argument to me, that like Democrats have like good policy reasons why they don't want Gorsuch on the court because he's a conservative. Is this the argument to go with on Gorsuch?
No. I mean, I think it's one of sort of several arguments that we can use. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump lacks good judgment in nearly all areas of life, as far as I can tell. When it comes to Gorsuch, I think there's sort of two arguments that Democrats should be focusing on. One is which the Republicans simply did not play by the rules when Obama put up his own nominee. They acted incredibly poorly, and now they're expecting collegial behavior from the Democrats in response. I think you don't give them that. I think, B, this administration has been a disaster from front to back, and I think the Democratic base is really, really hungry to see Democrats stand up and have a spine. And I think Gorsuch is one of many opportunities Democrats have to do that, and they should use that political capital, and they should use this political groundswell, remembering that their candidate did win 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And they should absolutely block Gorsuch's nomination, and don't be such kind of weenies and worry that, you know, next time Donald Trump's going to put up somebody worse.
So, Rich, this feels like the one political bright spot for Republicans this month. They feel good about the Gorsuch hearings. They feel good about his chances of being confirmed. And they feel good about a fight over the filibuster, that if Democrats try to filibuster Gorsuch, that will redound to their political advantage. But I assume that just ends with them nuking the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations, right?
Correct. So, Gorsuch, I thought he was just exemplary this week in the hearings. He was more polished and prepared than any of the politicians who were grilling him. He's a very knowledgeable man. He has some important liberal supporters. So I think at a tactical level, it would be a mistake for the Democrats to filibuster him. I understand they need to make the threat. They need to indicate to their base they're fighting. But the Republicans are united around Gorsuch. They'll exercise the nuclear option if there's a filibuster. And then the next nominee can't be filibustered. And that next nominee might not be as good as Gorsuch, might not unite the party. The stakes will be even higher because there's some chance a next nominee will be replacing a liberal on the court. So that's, I think, when, if you're a Democrat, when you'd want to have the filibuster fight, when there's some chance the Republicans wouldn't be united enough to exercise the nuclear option. Going this time guarantees a loss on this nomination and probably a loss on the next and subsequent ones.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jill Filipovich, what's your rant?
Sure. My rant today is rooms full of men making decisions for women. Photograph came out of Republican congressmen and advisors all sitting in a room, all men, no women in the frame, although there were reportedly a few women in the room, making decisions to cut maternal health care, pregnancy care, newborn care, care for women. This is not the first time we've seen a photo like this. It's always the photo op when Republicans do anti-abortion legislation. They need to start putting women at the table. If you're not sitting at the table, as Elizabeth Warren said, you're on the menu.
Susan Hennessy.
So my rant is, after Trump claimed again and again that his kids weren't going to be in government, Ivanka's getting a West Wing office and a security clearance. Surprise. So that's an ethics problem. It's a good governance problem. But more importantly, in light of this sort of bombshell New Yorker story that really raised questions about her involvement with a project tied to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, it's actually a national security problem. So people, keep your eye on the ball.
Rich Lowry.
I've talked a lot about the crisis of free speech on campus, very often excoriating faculty and students. So I'd like to take the opportunity to praise a campus and its faculty. The conservative thinker Charles Murray, who was literally violently shut down at Middlebury College a couple weeks ago, spoke without incident at Columbia University after 150 faculty members signed an open letter supporting his right to speak. Well done.
For my rant, the failure of the American Health Care Act this week is especially egregious because Donald Trump is supposed to be a great deal maker. This is the thing that he's supposed to be good at, is putting together coalitions like this, getting people to agree to things, and winning the negotiation over the deal. But not only did he failed because he made elementary deal-making mistakes. In particular, he showed his hand. He came out, and whenever he talked about this bill, he made clear that he was desperate to get something done so he could move on to what he really cared about, like tax reform, and that he didn't really care what was in the bill. That would invited the House Freedom Caucus to eat his lunch, insist on their terms, and then he lost the negotiation. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jill Filipovich, and Susan Hennessy. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of home. Let's go.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.